Mass media coverage of the anti-war demonstrations over the weekend was virtually non-existent. The Washington Post relegated the story to a blurb devoting a total of 10 lines to several major protests worldwide. Steve Rendell is a senior analyst at the media watchdog group Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting and co-host of Counterspin. Steve, 1.5 million Italians protested the impending war in this country. Tens of thousands of protesters, not in my name, dissenters gathered in New York, San Francisco, Los Angeles, Houston, Anchorage, Denver, and St. Louis, to name a few. And yet when I picked up the Washington Post this morning, no significant space was devoted to these mass demonstrations. Did I miss something?
I don't think so, Verna. I think what we're seeing here at FAIR is that our mainstream media is marginalizing, underreporting, in some cases absolutely disappearing dissent. For instance, today's New York Times story on the big demonstration in Central Park yesterday, which drew between 10 and 20,000 people, that story ran in the Metro section on page B3, even though, as you said, demonstrations happen across the country. Yesterday's demonstrations across the country were reported in today's Washington Post in a very brief Nation in Brief piece. Now, yesterday, the New York Times, this is Sunday, October 6th, the New York Times ran a front page piece talking about sort of the mixed feelings people across the country have about the war. And in that article, they were reporting from San Francisco, and they said, quote, California Peace Action is the state's largest peace organization with 30,000 members, though recent anti-war demonstrations sponsored by a variety of organizations in the Bay Area have drawn only small crowds. Well, in fact, the San Francisco Chronicle reported just a month ago that 10,000 people gathered in San Francisco's Golden Gate Park to demonstrate against the march to war in Iraq. Now, these are just some instances of how the stories have either been underreported or suppressed. We read here at FAIR that UPI is reporting that on Saturday, 1.5 million Italians took to the streets in various Italian cities to demonstrate against the Iraq war buildup.
Yes, indeed.
These are a lot of stories that we're not hearing enough about.
And why do you suppose that is? I mean, what's in it for the mass media to virtually ignore or to virtually black out coverage of these major events in this country?
Well, sometimes at FAIR demonstrations, we say 2, 4, 6, 8, separate the press and state. And this is just another example of that, where the press is acting as a cheerleader for a state policy. So we're seeing, for instance, this almost Orwellian disappearing of dissent, where they take stories that are inconvenient and flesh them down the memory hole.
Well, you say a cheerleader, but it almost seems as though they're complicit in some sort of conspiracy to silence what is a growing movement in this country.
Well, look, for instance, last week, Democracy Now! Canvassed the offices of 70 different senators and found that sentiment against the war was running from 10 to 1 up to 1,000 to 1 as far as the calls coming into the senators' offices. That's a big story that should have been covered by our mainstream media, but has not. But that shouldn't come as a big surprise when you look at what television, for instance, the network news and the cable news channels do when it comes to these war buildups. What do? Instead of offering a broad-ranging debate on how we should respond to different threats, instead of including in that debate the voices of human rights activists, international law experts, and people who are experts, scholars, and academics who have studied the conflict resolution traditions of Gandhi and Dr. King, instead of including them in the debate, no, they marginalize and completely erase them from the debate and run out and hire a bunch of militarists, a bunch of ex-generals and former Pentagon officials and such. So we shouldn't be surprised that we're not seeing this debate play out in our mainstream media. What people have to do is they have to come to shows like yours, to Democracy Now!, visit FAIR's website at www.fair.org, and they can pick up some of the information that they're not getting in the mainstream news.
But shouldn't they also contact these various news organizations and media and demand that they have fuller coverage of these events and a fuller team of analysts?
Absolutely. And the Washington Post today is a piece by the Washington Post ombudsman, which is in reaction. They don't name FAIR, but it's in reaction to a FAIR action alert. We have a listserv with 30,000 people on it, where if you sign up for free, you get one or two things a week, which point you to stories that are troublesome about mainstream U.S. media. And last week we reported that the New York Times and Washington Post gave more coverage to a demonstration in London against fox hunting than they gave to the huge demonstrations, which had from 150,000 to 400,000 anti-war protesters gathering. I think that was October 27th or October 28th. So the New York Times, the Washington Post gave more coverage to a demonstration against fox hunting, a worthy cause in itself, but still more coverage to a fox hunting demonstration than they did to a demonstration against the Iraq war. So we sent that out on our listserv, and hundreds of our activists, hundreds of our listserv members wrote to Michael Gettler at the Washington Post, and today Gettler agreed in the pages of the Washington Post that dissent and demonstrations were not being given fair reporting.
But why is it that the press is so cozy with the state in these instances? And does this point to any kind of historical pattern? What has been the case in the past when we come to these wars? I guess the recent past with the Gulf War and even prior to that.
Well, during the FAIR has been around since 1986, and in our entire history, even going back a couple of years before that to Grenada, what we've seen is uniform cheerleading for U.S. military adventures. We've seen that in Grenada. We saw it in 89 in Panama. We saw it in 90 and 91 in the Gulf War. We saw it throughout various skirmishes and wars that Bill Clinton had from 93 to 2000. And we're seeing it in Afghanistan, in Iraq. You see this getting behind the state policy. Why does it happen? Well, we think it's because they share a lot of the same interests. These media outlets are part of huge corporations that are that work in a sort of in tandem with the government. Not only do these television outlets and a lot of the newspaper companies own television outlets and vice versa, not only do they depend on politicians to pass felicitous legislation regarding broadcast licenses and the like, but also these same communication companies give large amounts of money when it comes time for candidates to run their campaigns. So there's this sort of synergy, this sort of nefarious synergy between the media corporations and the political establishment. And you can't also count out totally the sort of social scene in Washington, D.C. When we talk about this sort of news shaping, we're talking about the New York Times and the Washington Post, we're talking about the papers of record. And we're talking about journalists that get paid very well and move in very high, if you will, high social circles. A lot of times they play tennis with and go to dinner with some of the same politicians that they're supposed to be independent from, and holding these same politicians that they're supposed to be asking tough questions of and holding their feet to the fire. And there's just too cozy a relationship.
Steve Rendell of Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting. In a front page article in today's Post, the Iraqi war question is framed in terms of eight so-called important questions, with the majority of them presuming a war will take place. The article works in tandem with the mood in Congress that war is imminent. This week, members of the House and Senate will vote on a joint resolution granting Bush the right to attack Iraq. We go now to national affairs analyst Larry Binsky at Pacifica Station KPFA in Berkeley. Larry, the Post is predicting an easy victory for Bush on the resolution vote. What's your take on this?
My take is that the Democrats want to get this behind them as quickly as possible so they can get, in the month remaining before the election, some focus on the tremendous discontent about the economy that the American people are showing, most recently in the New York Times CBS poll that was released over the weekend. George W. Bush has tremendous weaknesses in being perceived as someone who doesn't care about, just like his father, people who aren't rich and wealthy like them, and having done little or nothing to help the economic circumstance of the country. So the Democrats want to get this out of the way. The problem for the Democrats, of course, is that they're abandoning their role as an oppositional party on the question of the potential attack on Iraq. And I think one of the things that this is doing is demoralizing the electorate that ordinarily would vote for Democrats. You have to realize that in the normal course of things, Congress would have adjourned last Friday. They haven't passed any one of the appropriations bills, the 13 that have to be passed in order for the government to continue through the next fiscal year. Many of them want to be back in their districts campaigning. They can't be doing that because they're stuck in Washington with the Iraq issue and their other unfinished business. So if this resolution does pass by large majorities in both houses, and I think it will, it'll be largely because both parties want to get this behind them and do what they like to do and in some cases have to do, which is campaign for re-election.
Mm. Is it possible that this change of position on the part of a number of Democrats, many whom were once doves on this issue, even as recently as the President George Bush's senior's war against Iraq or against Saddam Hussein back in 1991, many of these Democrats were doves at that time, and now they've turned into hawks. Is it possible they're merely reflecting the will or the opinion of the American people since 9/11?
Yes, it's possible they think they're doing that, but the support for the attack on Iraq is not as deep. And when you go, as the politicians are making it out to be, and when you go into public opinion, you find, for example, that only around 40% of the American public, when polled, believes that Iraq should be attacked without the United States having the support of the United Nations and allies, and an overwhelming percentage, something like two-thirds of the people, think that the United Nations weapons inspectors should go in and try to do their thing first. The Bush administration knows that the weapons inspector tactic can be dragged on for months and months, if not years and years, by Saddam Hussein and by the United Nations and by those mechanisms. This remains an ideology-driven move on the part of the Bush administration. They're hoping to drag as many Democrats with them as possible. Then they're hoping to say, well, look, if you really want a Republican, vote for a Republican. Why bother to vote for these Democrats anyway? The cave-in of Dick Gephardt on this and the very timid resistance being put up by Tom Daschle is probably going to hurt the Democrats in the short as well as the long run. But it's still a month till Election Day, and if the focus can be put back on the economy, which continues to deteriorate with bad job reports, continuing slumping stock markets, terrible new health plans being offered to workers in open enrollment periods, all of these play heavily against the Republicans. So the verdict is certainly not yet in on how the November election is going to turn out.
And I would assume that the Democrats are hoping that the election won't be a single issue. It won't really, people won't vote according to their position with regard to this war, since the Democrats seem to be towing the Republican Party line here. And they're hoping that the constituents will vote on the issues of health care and education and, you know, the economy, things that one might argue matter most to them.
Yeah, but you've still got to consider the possibility that a real or manufactured incident may take place with the continued bombing of Iraq by the United States and British forces, the possibility that one of those aircraft may be shot down or maybe seem to have been shot down. The refocusing of headlines then on the supposed hostile actions on the part of Saddam Hussein and the Iraqi government. I wouldn't put it past the Bush military and industrial establishment to pull one of those things, which is why they react in horror when anybody suggests it, like Congressman Jim McDermott suggested, that the Bush administration might lie to the American public about such a thing in its zeal to do what it wants to do in Iraq. But he's absolutely correct, and we still have a long time in which such a thing could happen before the election.
Of course, it seems as though many of those Democrats who have decided to speak out against this possible war, you mentioned James McDermott and, of course, David Bonnier, who accused Bush of lying after they visited Baghdad about a week or so ago. They have been openly ridiculed by Democratic Party leaders and tagged Baghdad Democrats, as well as the fact that former Vice President Al Gore, who many may recall, spoke out against the George W.'s position with regard to Saddam Hussein and was apparently soundly criticized by the Democratic establishment and hasn't had much to say about it since. So it doesn't seem like, at least from the party perspective, it's serving these Democrats who are speaking out against the war.
Well, the Democratic Party is not an opposition party to the Bush foreign policy right now. That's clear. But on the other hand, Verna, when you look around the country yesterday at all these demonstrations that happened, politicians take note of such things. And even though I don't know of any national elected officials from Congress who addressed these demonstrations, certainly there was nobody elected to anything who addressed the big one here in San Francisco that we broadcast yesterday. And as far as I know, not in New York or Los Angeles either. But it was very big yesterday for something that has had so little time to organize itself. It was very widespread. The politicians will take notice of that. The question is, will it have any effect on the November election? I think it remains to be seen. There's another major day of demonstrations coming up October 26th, much closer to the elections. And perhaps the anti-war spirit from the ground up will have a chance to percolate into the elected officials by then.
And I think also just as important, Larry, is the fact that will these politicians take note of this prior to the vote coming up this week?
No, I don't think so. I think the vote is set in stone for the reasons I've been saying, that they want to get this behind them. The language, unfortunately, really disempowers the United Nations and basically authorizes President Bush to do whatever he feels like doing, whenever he feels like doing it. It's not going to be that simple from the point of view of the Bush administration, which is aware of the American public's overwhelming suspicion of the Republicans' motives in bringing this to a head right now, and have the public's overwhelming skepticism and fear about unilateral action on the part of the United States. There's a lot to be played out before any attack actually could happen. But, of course, the military sources have been saying from the beginning that they don't want this to really happen anyway until January or February, when the climatic conditions are supposedly appropriate in Iraq.
National Affairs Analyst Larry Binsky of Pacifica Station KPFA in Berkeley. In Washington this past weekend, Georgetown University hosted the first annual conference of the Peace and Justice Studies Association, highlighting the role of peace educators and activists. Well-known peace activists, authors, professors, and students opened the conference with Democratic Congressman Bob Filner from California, who addressed this week's historic war resolution vote and what peace activists should be doing to respond to it.
This is a dangerous time, and I think the American people have not yet figured this all out yet of how dangerous it is. There has been very little noise from the country. And when people ask me what to do, you can do your regular thing, call your congressman and write your congressperson, but we have to make noise. There is no other choice, I think, at this moment, and that noise... that noise has got to be heard. Interestingly enough, the letters and calls that are coming into the Congress are at least 10 to 1 against this. It's amazing. I have gone through all the classified briefings that none of you are privy to. I have not heard one thing in those briefings that accounts for the timing of this particular action at this particular time. Nothing has happened in Iraq to say this is the moment. What occurred, of course, was that the president and his party were going through a whole several months of attack for, you know, corporate accountability, the stock market falling out of going to the tubes, 401k pensions disappearing, nobody getting their prescription drug benefit as a part of Medicare, Social Security trying to be privatized. All of those things are now off the table. There's no secret. There's no coincidence as why we are doing this at this moment. They are cynically and calculating doing this to win an election. That's as simple as all that. I believe a unilateral preemptive strike will, in fact, is not only contrary to international law, that's a minor thing, but it will make us less secure as a nation. Less secure, not more secure. If the president wants to talk about security, let's talk about security. When I said this was about the election, I meant it in the following way. Because of our wonderful campaign financing system and the way your districts are gerrymandered in a way that you don't know how it happened and it has happened and your whole political choices have been set for the next decade and you don't even know how it happened, most of you, I would bet. The seats are fixed. The last two elections, Congress people were elected, the re-election rate was 98.6%. That's higher, by the way, than the Soviet Union ever had at the height of the one-party state.
We're number one.
We have fixed the seats. There's about 100 people that don't even have an opponent. You can yell all you want. The seats are fixed for one party or the other. They are counting heavily on the two things I told you.
What is your call to action?
But I think we have to revive some of the things that are out of style. We should be leading teach-ins around the country. We should be there should be demonstrations. There should be marches. I think, again, there has to be noise. And that's our, I think, our responsibility to do that. I know they ran a people's revolution in Philippines a year and a half ago off their text messaging. Meet at 10th and Maple in Manila tomorrow at 1. They had 100,000 people or 500,000 people, and they overthrew a president. Several people have asked, you know, why aren't your colleagues doing this or that? Don't look to Congress to do much of anything, by the way, in that everybody there is a short-term thinker. They're thinking about November 5th. I would not count on the United States Congress to lead the effort. Some of the Congress people might be part of that effort, but people from the grassroots, as we say, have got to do this. Most peace groups, environmentalists, others, are all my friends, and I asked them, when's the last time you went to a Kiwanis club? They said, well, we can't go there. They're all against us. That's the point. If you can't convince the Kiwanis club, you're not going to convince the congressperson. And we haven't used the avenues of the weeklies and monthlies and neighborhood things. We haven't used the talk shows, and we haven't used the going to the service clubs, the PTAs, the church groups. That's where the politicians get their public opinion.
Democratic Congressman Bob Filner from California. Some activists and war veterans say the effects of a war on Iraq will threaten the U.S.'s national security, its economy, and could unleash uncontrollable forces here and abroad. Reem Kathuta from WPFW in Washington, D.C., spoke with some of them at D.C.'s social forum at the American University recently and in the mobilization called at noon today at the North Senate Park on Capitol Hill.
The representatives that they need to represent their constituents. If they vote for a war and if they attack Iraq, they are going to be creating an anti-war movement in the United States like they haven't seen since the Vietnam War, that it's going to tear the country apart. And if they want to avoid something like that, they need to slow down the rush to war. So the important thing this week is to get that point across, that they are going to really be escalating things in the U.S. if they support a war. There's a lot of possible effects of an anti-war movement. Everything from using our economic power to boycott gasoline, since so many of us think that this is a war for oil, to really politicizing young people who haven't been politicized yet and who are willing to put their bodies on the gears of the machine to slow down the war machine and really disrupt things.
Sherry Brown, and I'm a local political peace and justice activist and a longtime political activist. Our government is sending the wrong message, and I see a connection between what is happening and the White House and the president beating the drums of war and this sniper who's running around shooting people randomly in the Washington metropolitan area. A 13-year-old boy was just shot at an elementary school in Prince George's County. When the government sends the message that it's okay to use violence to solve problems, that sends a message to those in our society who may not be able to process messages rationally, to the nutcases out there, or to just people who just want to use the quickest means to resolve a problem as opposed to using more peaceful means to resolve a dispute. What is going on locally is directly connected to what's happening nationally and internationally, you know.
Eric Gustafson, a Gulf War veteran and the executive director of EPIC, the Education for Peace in Iraq Center.
The fact is, if we do not prevent this, if the U.S. goes forward, the world will become a less safe place. It will become one of the biggest recruiting posters for any extremist out there, and that will endanger our national security. So what's so fascinating is even from a very conservative standpoint in speaking about national security, you can make the arguments why a war on Iraq is not in the best interest of this country.
With us is Ellen Barfield from Baltimore. She's one of the activists calling for actions to stop the war on Iraq.
I am a military veteran.
I did put my body on the line for military purposes in times past, and now I put my body on the line to resist military purposes. I served from 77 to 81. The thing I did that was interesting was serve in Korea in 1980 when there was a big massacre there. That was the kind of behavior that our government does around the world. It wasn't a war, but it was a killing of over 2,000 Koreans because a U.S.-instigated coup had happened the year before. Well, in a much bigger way, that's what Bush wants to do now, have a coup in Iraq. I was a sergeant. I was a heavy equipment mechanic, so I don't have combat expertise. I do, however, have knowledge of what it's like to be in the military, how one suspends one's conscience and thoughts and just is supposed to do what one is told with no consideration of what might happen from that. And very, very briefly, in my basic training, the initial training you get when you first enlist, for just a few minutes, one hot Alabama summer afternoon, they did mention that all of us had the right and the responsibility to disobey an unlawful order. And this was in 1977, just a few years after the My Lai massacre in Vietnam. And I knew why they said that. They said that, they taught us that in our basic training lecture because they had to, because they were forced to by the horror at the My Lai massacre. At a massacre of civilians in a town, in a village that had no effect on the war in Vietnam, they were simply massacred because U.S. troops had gotten the feeling that everybody there was dangerous to them and they were just mowing down everybody they could. That's what happens in war. You unleash the dogs of war and lots of innocent people die. And so they gave in my basic training that very brief acknowledgement that yes, that's true. And then they went right on again with all the real purpose of the military, which is to be there armed and dangerous when your government wants you to be and to kill who they tell you to kill. This nation and the others, which remain fully armed with weapons of mass destruction, have no indication of disarming themselves. They must proceed to do that too. The whole world needs to get rid of weapons of mass destruction, not just Iraq. And in particular, and first of all, the Middle East region. That was Article 14, I believe it was, one of the articles of 687, the United Nations Security Council resolution in 1991 that ended, that was the ceasefire in Iraq. It said we must disarm, take away weapons of mass destruction from the entire region, not just Iraq. Well, the rest of the region has had weapons poured into it since 91, and Israel remains the nation that is known to have several hundred nuclear weapons, weapons of mass destruction. That has a tremendous impact. Of course it impacts the whole region. If the U.S. attacks Iraq, the flames will just rise higher. It's all very interconnected. And the U.S. is very threatened if the situation continues with no change in Israel.
You've been listening to Imperatives for Peace, Pacifica's Peace Watch. Produced by Scott Gurian. Tonight's engineer was Rolando Arrieta. Our consultants are Sam Husseini and Larry Binsky. We had production assistance from Laurel Paget-Seekings, web help from Pete Caracas, and technical assistance this evening from Robbie Brown and Sidrak Franklin. I'm Verna Avery Brown. Thank you for listening.